was no cure, in principle. There were places in the underground world where the embers of scientific thought continued to glow, where research was carried out, new medicines were developed, and serums were manufactured. Polis, for example, that confluence of four major arteries, the heart of the metro, the last remaining simulacrum of a genuine city that extended through the connecting passages between the Arbat, Borovitskaya, Alexander Garden, and Lenin Library stations, where the doctors and scientists who survived had established their base, or the immense bunker near Taganka station, the secret technopolis that belonged to Hansa. And apart from that, Tula might not be the first station where the epidemic had broken out. What if someone had already managed to beat the sickness? How could I possibly abandon so easily any hope of being saved? Homer asked himself. Of course, now that he was carrying the time bomb of the disease in his own body, the old man had a vested interest in this kind of reasoning. In his rational mind, Homer had almost accepted the idea that he would die soon. But his instincts rebelled, demanding that he try to find a way out. If he could find a way to save Tula, he would protect his home station from harm and be saved himself. But Hunter simply didn't believe there was any cure for this disease. After exchanging a few words with the watch at Tula on a single occasion, he had condemned all the inhabitants of the station to death and immediately set about putting the sentence into effect. He had misled the top command of Sebastopol with wild stories about nomads, imposed his own decision on them, and was now inexorably approaching the point of making it a reality by committing Tula to the flames. Or did he know about something happening at the station that turned everything topsy-turvy again? Something that neither Homer nor the man who left his diary at Nachimov Prospekt knew about. When he was done with the bodies, the brigadier tugged his flask off his belt and sucked out the remains of its contents. What was it? Alcohol? Did he use his hooch as a condiment to help him savor his actions? Or was he trying to kill the aftertaste? Was he relishing the moment, or trying to escape from it? Or perhaps he hoped that with alcohol he could smother something inside himself? For Sasha, the smoky old motor trolley was a time machine out of the bedtime stories her father once used to amuse her with. It wasn't carrying the girl from Kolomenskoye to Autosavod, but taking her back from the present into the past, although no one but her could possibly have thought of the stone dungeon where she had spent all these years, that blind alley in space and time, as the present. She remembered the journey in the other direction very well. She was still only a little girl, her father, tightly bound with a woolly hat pulled down over his eyes and a gag in his mouth, sat beside her. She cried all the time, and one of the soldiers in the firing squad folded his fingers together and showed her various shadow animals in the little yellow circus ring that was running along the ceiling of the tunnel, racing with the trolley. The sentence was read out to her father after they crossed the bridge. The Revolutionary Tribunal commuted his sentence from execution to lifelong banishment. They pushed him out onto the rails, tossed him a knife, a submachine gun with one clip of cartridges, and an old gas mask, then helped Sasha get down. The soldier who had shown the little girl the horsey and the doggy waved to her. Could he be one of the men who had been shot today? The feeling of breathing someone else's air grew stronger when she squirmed into a black gas mask taken off one of the bodies by the man with the shaved head. Every tiny little stretch of her journey cost someone's life. The man with the shaved head would probably have shot them anyway, but now that Sasha was here, she was an accomplice. It wasn't only because he was tired of fighting that her father hadn't wanted to come home. He used to say that all his humiliations and deprivations weighed less than even a single human life. He suffered in order not to cause suffering to others. Sasha knew that the pan of the scales holding all the lives he had taken already hung very, very low, and her father was simply trying to restore the balance. But the man with the shaved head could have intervened sooner, couldn't he? He could have simply frightened the men on the trolley just by appearing, and disarmed them without firing a single shot. Sasha was sure of that. None of the dead men was a worthy opponent for him. Why did he have to do that? The station of her childhood was closer than she thought. In less than 10 minutes, its lights were glimmering ahead of them. There was no one guarding the approaches to Autosavod, the station's inhabitants obviously placed too much faith in the locked hermetic doors. 50 meters before the platform, the man with the shaved head switched the engine to low speed and told Homer to take the helm while he moved closer to the machine gun. The trolley rolled into the station almost without a sound, and very, very slowly. Or perhaps time was standing still for Sasha, so that she could see everything and remember it all in a few brief moments. On that day, her father had left her in the care of his orderly, telling him to hide her until everything was sorted out. The orderly led her deep into the underbelly of the station to one of the service areas. But even from there they could hear the simultaneous roar of 1,000 throats, and he went dashing back to be with his commander. Sasha hurtled along the empty corridor behind him and darted out into the hall. They drifted along the platform, and Sasha looked at the spacious family tents and the carriages equipped as offices, the little kids playing tag and the old men chatting, the sullen men cleaning their guns. And she saw her father standing in front of a thin line of angry, frightened men who were trying to enclose and restrain a raging crowd. She ran over to her father and pressed herself against his back. He swung round crazily, shook her off, and slapped his adjutant in the face as he came hurrying up. But something had already happened to him. The line of men, which had frozen with its automatic weapons, raised in anticipation of the command to open fire, was ordered to stand down. The only shot was one fired into the air. Her father started negotiations on the peaceful handover of the station to the revolutionaries. Her father believed that a man was given signs. You just had to know how to see them and read them correctly. No, time hadn't slowed down just so that she could revisit the final day of her childhood. She spotted the armed men rising to meet the trolley before the others did. She saw the man with the shaved head reach the trigger switch with an elusive fluid movement and start turning the thick, burnished barrel towards the amazed sentries. She heard the hissed command to halt the trolley before the old man did, and Sasha realized so many people would be killed now that she would feel as if she were breathing someone else's air for the rest of her life. But she could still prevent the massacre. Save them, and herself, and one other man from something more appalling than any words could express. The sentries were already taking their automatics off the safety catches, but they fiddled with them too long and were several moves behind the man with the shaved head. She did the first thing that came into her mind. She jumped up and pressed herself against his lumpy, iron-hard back, hugging him from behind and clasping her hands on his chest, which was so still it didn't seem to be breathing. He shuddered as if she had lashed him with a whip, hesitated. The sentries, finally ready to fire, were bewildered too. The old man understood her without any words. The trolley shot off down the tracks, belching out black clouds of bitter smoke, and Altosavod station receded rapidly, back into the past. All the way to Pavelet station, no one spoke another word. Hunter freed himself from the unexpected embrace, parting the girl's arms as if he were bending open a steel hoop that prevented him from breathing. They slipped past the only guard post at full speed, and the spray of bullets directed at them from it bit into the ceiling above their heads. The brigadier managed to pull out his pistol and reply with 3 soundless flashes of flame. He seemed to have brought one man down, but the others melted into the walls, squeezing themselves in behind the shallow lips of the tunnel liners to save themselves. "My, my," thought Homer, glancing at the girl, who was quiet and subdued now. He had assumed the love line would come into play soon after the heroine's appearance, but everything was developing too fast, faster than he could understand it all, let alone write it down. They rode into Pavelet station and stopped. The old man had been here before, at this station straight out of the mists of Gothic legend. Instead of the plain columns that supported the vaults in all the newer outlying stations of the metro, Pavelet station was supported by a series of airy, rounded arches that were too high for ordinary people. In typical fashion for legends of that kind, Pavelet was the victim of a distinctive curse. At precisely 8 o'clock in the evening, the hustle and bustle suddenly died away, and the thriving station was transformed into its own ghost. Out of its entire dynamic and resourceful population, only a few daredevils were left on the platform. Everyone else disappeared, together with their children, personal effects, trunks stuffed with goods, benches and makeshift beds. They all crammed into the refuge, the almost kilometre-long connecting passage to the Circle Line, and trembled there through the long night, while monstrous creatures who had woken from their sleep prowled around on the surface of the Pavelets railway station. People who ought to know said these creatures were the unchallenged masters of the station building and the adjoining territory, and even while they slept no other beasts would dare to wander in there. The inhabitants of Pavelets had no defences against them. The shutters that cut off the escalators at other stations simply didn't exist here, and the way out to the surface was always open. To Homer's mind, it would have been hard to find anywhere less appropriate for an overnight halt. But Hunter thought differently. When the trolley reached the far end of the hall, it stopped.
"We'll stay here until the morning. Make yourselves at home,"
he said, pulling off his gas mask and waving his hand round at the station, and he left them. The girl watched him go, then curled up on the hard floor of the trolley. The old man made himself as comfortable as possible, and closed his eyes, trying to doze off, but in vain. He was besieged again by thoughts of the plague that he was carrying round all the stations that were still uninfected. The girl couldn't sleep either.
"Thank you. I thought you were the same as him," she told Homer.
"I don't think there are any other men like that," the old man replied.
"Are you two friends?"
"Like a sucker fish and a shark," he said with a grim smile,
thinking that was exactly the way it was. Hunter devoured people, but occasional bloody scraps of human flesh came his way too.
"How do you mean?"
she asked, half sitting up.
"Where he goes, I go. I don't think I could manage without him, and he... perhaps he thinks that I'll absolve him somehow, although no one really knows what he thinks."
"But why can't you manage without him?"
asked the girl, moving to sit closer to the old man.
"I have the feeling that while I'm with him, my inspiration won't desert me,"
Homer tried to explain.
"Inspiration? I read somewhere that means breathing in,"
said Alexandra.
"But why do you want to breathe that? What good will it do you?"
Homer shrugged.
"It's not what we breathe in. It's what's breathed into us," he replied.
"I think that as long as you breathe death, no one will kiss your lips. They'll be scared of the rotten corpse smell,"
she said, drawing something on the dirty floor with her finger.
"When you see death, it makes you think about many things,"
Homer remarked.
"You don't have any right to summon death every time you need to think,"
she objected.
"I don't summon it. I just stand there. And then, it hasn't really got anything to do with death. Or not only with death,"
the old man countered.
"I wanted a story to happen to me, a story that would change everything. I wanted something to happen in my life, to shake me up and clear out my head."
"Did you have a bad life?"
the girl asked sympathetically.
"A boring one. You know, when one day's like any other, they fly by so fast and it seems like the last one is really close already,"
Homer tried to explain.
"You feel afraid of not getting anything finished. And every one of those days is full of a thousand little things to be done. Do one, take a break, and it's time to start on the next one. You have no time or strength left for what's really important. You think, 'Never mind, I'll start tomorrow.' But tomorrow never comes. It's always just one long, endless today."
"Have you seen many stations?"
She didn't seem to be following what the old man was telling her at all.
"I don't know," he replied, puzzled. "All of them, probably."
"And I've seen two,"
the girl sighed.
"First my father and I lived at Autosavod, then we were exiled to Kolomenskoye. I always wanted to see at least one more. It's so strange here."
She ran her eyes along the line of arches.
"As if there were a thousand gateways, and not even any walls between them. And there they are, all open for me. But I don't want to go through. And I'm afraid."
"So, it was your father. That man, the other one,"
Homer hesitated.
"Did they kill him?"
The girl retreated back into her shell of silence for a long time before she responded.
Yes.
Stay with us, said the old man, plucking up his nerve. I'll have a word with Hunter. I think he'll agree. I'll tell him I need you, for...
He shrugged, not knowing how to explain to the girl that now she had to inspire him.
Tell him he needs me, said Sasha.
She jumped down onto the platform and wandered away from the trolley, stroking every column as she walked past it. There was absolutely nothing coy about her. She didn't flirt at all. Along with all kinds of firearms, she seemed to despise the standard female arsenal. Those sweet little glances and heart-melting gestures, those fluttering eyelashes that can raise a hurricane, and those half-smiles for which a man would sacrifice himself or kill another. Or was it that she simply didn't know yet how to use these weapons? Whatever the reason, she could manage without them. A single dagger thrust from those eyes of hers had made Hunter reverse a decision. A single movement from her had snared him in a net and kept him from killing. But had that thrust really pierced through his armor into the soft flesh? Or did he need her for something? That was probably it. It seemed strange to Homer even to imagine that the Brigadier had any vulnerable spots, that he could even be pricked, let alone wounded. Homer simply couldn't sleep. Although he had swapped the stifling black gas mask for a light respirator, he still found it just as hard to breathe, and the vice that was crushing his head hadn't slackened its grip. Homer had dumped all his old things in the tunnel. He had scrubbed his hands clean with a piece of grey soap, washed off the dirt with greenish water from an old fuel can, and made a voluntary decision always to wear a white face mask from now on. What else could the old man do to avoid danger to people he was with? Nothing. Absolutely nothing at all now. Not even going into the tunnel and reducing himself to an abandoned heap of rotten rags would do any good. But today's close brush with death had suddenly taken him back 20 years, to the days when he had just lost everyone he loved. And that had given his plans a new, authentic meaning. If it was up to Homer, he would have erected a genuine monument to them. But they surely deserved at least a basic headstone. Born decades apart, they had all died on the same day. His wife, his children, his parents. And there were all his classmates from school and friends from the technical college, his favorite movie actors and musicians, and all those people who were still at work that day, or had already got home, or were stuck somewhere halfway in the traffic jams. The ones who died immediately, and the ones who tried to survive, lingering for a few more days in the poisoned, half-ruined capital, scraping feebly at the locked hermetic doors of the metro. The ones who disintegrated instantly into atoms, and the ones who swelled up and crumbled away while still alive, devoured by radiation sickness. The scouts who went up onto the surface first couldn't get to sleep for days after they returned from their mission. Homer had met some of them round the campfires at transfer stations. He had looked into their eyes and seen streets like frozen rivers swollen with dead fish imprinted on those eyes forever. Thousands of stalled cars with dead passengers choked the avenues and the highways leading out of Moscow. Dead bodies were lying everywhere. Until the city's new masters arrived, there was no one to clear them away. To spare themselves, the scouts tried to avoid the schools and kindergartens. But to lose your mind, it was enough to catch a single frozen gaze from the back seat of a family car. Billions of lives were broken off simultaneously. Billions of thoughts were left unspoken. Billions of dreams were left unrealized. Billions of grievances were left unforgiven. Nikolai's little son had asked him for a big set of colored felt-tip pens. His daughter had been afraid to go to her figure skating lessons. Before she went to sleep, his wife had described in vivid detail how they would spend a short holiday by the sea together. Just the two of them. When he thought that these little wishes and desires were the last they had, they suddenly became exceptionally important. Homer would have liked to carve an epitaph for each one of them. But humanity certainly deserved at least one epitaph for its gigantic mass grave. and now when he himself had almost no time left, Homer felt he could find the right words for it. He still didn't know what order to arrange them in, what he would use to bind them together, how he would embellish them, but he could already sense that the story unfolding before his very eyes would have a place for every restless, troubled soul, for every single feeling and every crumb of knowledge that he had gathered so painstakingly, and for him too. No plot could have suited his purpose better. When dawn came up on the surface, the rows of market stalls would stir into life down below, and then he would definitely take a walk along them to get himself a clean exercise book and a ballpoint pen. And he had to hurry. If he didn't get down on paper the outlines of the future novel that he could see glimmering like a mirage ahead of him, it could melt away. And who could say how much longer he would have to sit on the summit of his sand dune, gazing into the distance, and hoping that his ivory tower would start rising up again out of the fine grains of sand and the shimmering, incandescent air. There might not be enough time.
No matter what nonsense the girl might talk, a glance into the empty eye sockets of eternity is certainly a great stimulus to action,
the old man chuckled to himself. And then recalling the arches of her eyebrows, two flashes of white on the somber, grimy face, and the bite marks on her lip and her tousled straw-blonde hair, he smiled again.
I'll have to find something else at the market tomorrow as well,
Homer thought as he fell asleep. Night at Pavelet station is always restless. Glimmers of light from the smoking torches flicker across the soot-stained marble walls. The tunnels breathe uneasily, and the men sitting at the foot of the escalators talk to each other in voices so low they can hardly be heard. The station pretends to be dead, hoping the predatory beasts from the surface won't be tempted by the smell of meat. But sometimes, the most curious of those beasts discover a passage that leads down deep, start sniffing at it, and catch the scent of fresh sweat, the beating of hearts, the murmur of blood coursing through veins. And they set off, downwards. Homer had finally dozed off, and the alarmed voices from the far end of the platform filtered into his awareness as dull, distorted echoes. But then a shot rang out, instantly jerking him out of his hazy half-sleep. The old man jumped up, staring around wildly and groping for his gun on the floor of the trolley. The deafening, thunderous rumbling of the machine gun was joined by the stuttering of several submachine guns, and the alarm in the sentry's shouts was replaced by genuine terror. Whoever it was they were firing all their weapons at, it wasn't having any effect. This was no longer coordinated fire at a moving target, but the desperate, ragged shooting of men simply trying to save their own skins. Homer found his automatic, but he couldn't make himself go out into the hall. It took all his willpower to resist the temptation to start the motor and shoot out of the station at top speed. It didn't matter a damn where to. But he stayed in the trolley, craning his neck to make out the battle zone through the crowded line of the columns. Slicing through the yelling and swearing of the sentries trying to defend themselves came a piercing shriek that sounded surprisingly close. The machine gun choked, and someone gave a terrible scream that was cut short as suddenly as if his head had been torn off. The chatter of submachine guns hammered at Homer's ears again, but now it was sparse and scattered. The shriek was repeated. It sounded a little further away now, and suddenly the creature that made it was answered by an echo, somewhere close to the trolley. Homer counted to 10 and started the motor with trembling hands. Any moment now his companions would come back, and they could go racing off immediately. He was doing it for their sake, not his own. The trolley trembled and smoked as the motor warmed up, and then something flickered between the columns at an unbelievable speed, blurring past and slithering out of view faster than his mind could process the image. The old man grabbed hold of the handrail, set his foot on the accelerator pedal, and took a deep breath. If they didn't come in the next 10 seconds, he'd just drop everything and then, without even knowing why he was doing it, Homer stepped out onto the platform, holding his useless automatic out in front of him, just to make sure that there was nothing more he could still do for either of his companions. He pressed himself tight against a column and glanced out into the hall. He tried to scream, but he didn't have enough air. Sasha had always known the world wasn't limited to the two stations where she had lived, but she could never have imagined that the world beyond them could be so beautiful. Dull and bleak as Kolomenskoye was, to her it seemed like a home, cozy and familiar in every little detail. Autosavot was haughty and spacious, but cold. It had turned its back on her father and her, rejected them, and she couldn't forget that. But in her relationship with Pavelets, she could turn a new leaf, and Sasha's desire to fall in love with this station grew stronger with every minute she spent there. She wanted to fall in love with its light, branching columns, with its huge, inviting arches, with its noble marble covered in darling little veins that made the walls look like someone's delicate skin. Kolomenskoye was ugly, Autosavod was too severe, but this station seemed to have been built by a woman. It was playful, even frivolous. Even decades on, Pavelets refused to forget its own former glory. The people who lived here couldn't be vicious and cruel, Sasha thought. Did she and her father really only have to get past one hostile station in order to find themselves in this magical land? Would it really have been enough for him to live just one more day in order to escape from his exile and hard labor and be free again? She would have been able to persuade the man with the shaved head to take both of them. In the distance, a campfire flickered, surrounded by sentries, and the beam of a searchlight probed at the high ceiling. But Sasha didn't want to go that way. For so many years it had seemed to her that once she broke out of Kolomenskoye and met other people, she would be happy. But now Sasha needed only one person, to share her delight and amazement that now the world really was bigger by a whole third, and her hope that everything could still be put right. But there probably wasn't anyone at all who needed Sasha, no matter what she might try to make herself and the old man believe. So the girl wandered off in the opposite direction, to where a dilapidated train stood halfway into the right tunnel, with its windows broken and doors wide open. She walked inside and along through the train, soaring over the gaps between the carriages, as she inspected the first, the second, the third. In the last one, Sasha found a seat that had miraculously survived and clambered onto it, pulling up her legs. She looked round, trying to imagine that any moment now the train would start moving and carry her on to more stations, brightly lit and vibrant with human voices. But her faith and imagination weren't strong enough to set thousands of tons of scrap iron moving. It had all been so much easier with her bicycle, and her attempt to hide failed. Skipping from carriage to carriage in her wake, the noise of the battle unfolding in Pavelets station finally caught up with her. Again. She lowered her feet onto the floor and dashed back to the station, to the only place where she could at least do something. The mutilated bodies of sentries were lying by the glass booth with the frozen searchlight, and in the extinguished campfire, and in the center of the hall. Those men had already abandoned any resistance and were running to seek refuge in the passage, but death had overtaken them halfway there. A sinister, unnatural figure was doubled up over one of the bodies. From that distance it was hard to make it out clearly, but Homer saw smooth white skin, an immensely powerful twitching neck, and legs bent at too many joints, with impatiently shuffling feet. The battle had been lost. But where was Hunter? The old man peeped again and froze in horror. About 10 steps away from him, more than 2 meters up in the air, a nightmarish face was staring at him, peeping out from behind a column exactly like Homer, as if it was playing peekaboo. Something red was dripping from the drooping lower lip. The lower jaw was working incessantly, grinding up its hideous cud, and the space below the sloping forehead was absolutely empty. But the lack of eyes didn't seem to cause the beast any difficulty in moving about and attacking. Homer pulled back, squeezing the trigger. His automatic didn't make a sound. The monster let out a long, deafening howl and darted into the center of the hall. The old man started jerking the jammed breech backwards and forwards, realizing he didn't have enough time. But suddenly the monster lost all interest in him. Now its attention was riveted to the edge of the platform. Homer swung round sharply, following the line of that blind gaze, and his heart stopped dead. The girl was standing there, gazing round in fright. "Run!" Homer yelled, his voice instantly breaking into a croak that scraped at his throat. The white monster sprang forward, covering several meters in a single bound, and stood in front of the girl. She pulled out a knife that was useless for anything but cooking and made a warning lunge. In reply, the beast swung one of its front paws, and the girl collapsed on the ground. Her knife went flying several meters through the air. The old man was already on the trolley, but he wasn't thinking about running away anymore. Puffing and panting, he swung the machine gun round, trying to catch that white, dancing silhouette in the cobweb lines of the sight. He couldn't. The monster was moving in on Sasha. Homer had the impression that after savaging the sentries who represented at least some kind of danger to it, the creature was amusing itself by driving two helpless victims into a corner and toying with them before it finished them off. Now it was hunched over Sasha, screening her from the old man's view, skinning its prey. Suddenly it jerked and staggered backwards, scraping with its claws at a dark patch spreading across its back, and swung round with a roar, preparing to devour its attacker. Treading unsteadily, holding his automatic out in one hand, Hunter walked towards it. His other arm dangled limply at his side, and it was clear that every step he took cost him an immense effort and great pain. The brigadier raked the monster with another burst of fire, but the creature was incredibly tough. It merely swayed, then immediately recovered its balance and came hurtling forward. Hunter had run out of cartridges, and he pivoted round in an incredible turn, taking the immense carcass on the blade of his machete as the monster collapsed down onto him, stifling him with its sheer weight and breaking his bones. The second monster came running up to destroy any remaining hope. It froze over the twitching body of its fellow and plucked at the white skin with its claw as if trying to wake the other beast up, then slowly raised its eyeless face towards the old man. Homer didn't miss his chance. The heavy caliber bullets shredded the monster's torso and shattered its skull, knocking it to the ground, then continued reducing the marble slabs behind its back to chips and dust. It was some time before the old man could calm his heart and unclasp his cramped fingers. Then he closed his eyes, took off his respirator, and let the frosty air, saturated with the rusty smell of fresh blood, flood into him. All the heroes had fallen. He was left alone on the battlefield. His book was over, before it had even begun.
Chapter 10. After Death.
What remains after people die? What will remain after each one of us? Gravestones subside and become overgrown with moss, and it takes only a few decades for the inscriptions on them to become illegible. Even in former times, when no one was left to take care of graves, the ground in a cemetery was redistributed among the newly deceased. The only people who came to visit the dead were their children or parents. Grandchildren came far more rarely. Great-grandchildren almost never. In major cities, what was customarily referred to as eternal peace meant a respite of only half a century before the bones would be disturbed, perhaps so that more remains could be crammed into the cemetery, or perhaps so that it could be plowed up and a new residential district built on it. The earth was becoming too cramped for both the living and the dead. Half a century is a luxury that only those who died before doomsday could afford. Who can be concerned with a single dead man when an entire planet dies? None of the inhabitants of the Metro has ever been afforded the honor of being buried, or been able to hope that his body will not be destroyed by rats. Formerly, remains had the right to exist for exactly as long as the living remember the people to whom they belonged. A man remembers his relatives, his schoolfellows, and his workmates. But his memory is only long enough for three generations, for that same period of 50-something years. In the same careless manner as we all discard from our memory the image of our grandfather or school friend, someday someone will discard us into absolute oblivion. The memory of a man can last for longer than his skeleton, but when the last of those who still remember us departs, we dissolve into time with him. Photos? Who still has them made these days? And how many of them were kept, even when everyone used to take them? At one time, at the end of every thick family album, there used to be a small reservation for
old, brownish snapshots. But not many of those who lived through the albums could say for certain which of his ancestors they depicted. In effect, photographs of the departed can be regarded as death masks, cast from the body, but certainly not life masks, cast from the soul. And then, photos decay only slightly more slowly than the bodies of the people they recorded. So what does remain? Children? Homer touched the candle flame with his finger. It was easy for him to intellectualize. What Ahmed had said was still tormenting him. Condemned to remain childless, deprived of any chance to continue his line, now the old man could only deny the reality of his route to immortality. He picked up his pen again.
They can look like us. In their features we can see our own features, miraculously fused with the features of those we have loved, recognizing ourselves in their gestures, in the curve of their eyebrows, in their facial expressions. We will be moved to tenderness. Friends might tell us that our sons and daughters are like stenciled copies of us, that they are cast from the same mold, and this supposedly promises us some kind of continuation of ourselves after we cease to exist. But after all, none of us is an initial image from which subsequent copies are made, but merely a phantasmagorical combination, composed half and half of the external and internal features of our father and our mother, exactly as they in turn consist of halves of their own parents. Does this mean there is nothing unique about us? That there is only an eternal reshuffling of tiny little pieces of the mosaic which exist in their own right, combining at random into billions of pictures that have no particular value and crumble away before our very eyes? If so, what sense does it make to be so proud of the fact that we see in our children this particular hook of the nose or that particular dimple in the cheek which we are used to thinking of as our own, but which has really been wandering through thousands of bodies for 500,000 years already? Will anything remain after me, in particular? Homer had a harder time than other people. He genuinely envied those whose faith allowed them to hope for admission into an afterworld. As for him, when he heard it mentioned in conversation, the old man's thoughts immediately flew back to Nachimov Prospekt. Quite possibly Homer did not consist only of the flesh that would be ground up and digested by the corpse-eaters. But even if there was something else in him, that something was not capable of existing apart from the flesh and bone. What remained after the kings of Egypt, or after the heroes of Greece, or after the artists of the Renaissance? Did anything at all remain of them? And did they remain in anything? But what other immortality is left to man?
Homer reread what he had written, pondered for a moment, and then carefully tore the pages out of the exercise book, crumpled them up, put them on a metal plate, and set fire to them. A minute later, a handful of ash was all that remained of the work on which he had spent the last 3 hours. She died. This was how Sasha had always imagined death. The final ray of light is extinguished. All the voices fall silent. You can't feel your body. And all that's left is eternal darkness. The blackness and silence from out of which people emerge, and to which they inevitably return. Sasha had heard stories about heaven and about hell, but the underworld had always seemed perfectly innocuous to her. Eternity spent in total inactivity, absolutely blind and deaf, seemed 100 times worse to her than any cauldrons of boiling oil. And then a tiny, trembling flame appeared ahead of her. Sasha reached out to it, but it was impossible to catch. The dancing firefly ran away from her, moved back closer to tease her, and immediately darted away again, tantalizing her, luring her after itself. She knew what it was, the tunnel spark. Her father used to say that when someone died in the metro, their soul wandered in confusion through the pitch-dark tangle of tunnels, and every tunnel ended in a dead end. It didn't understand that it wasn't attached to a body any longer, that its earthly existence was over. It had to carry on wandering until somewhere far ahead it saw the light of a phantom campfire. And when the soul saw the light, it had to hurry towards it, because it was sent for the soul, and would run away, leading the soul to a place where peace was waiting. But sometimes it happened that the little light took mercy on a soul and led it back to its lost body. Other people whispered about people like that, saying they had come back from the next world, although it would be more correct to say the darkness had released them. The spark called for her to follow. It insisted, and Sasha gave in. She couldn't feel her legs, but they weren't needed. In order to keep up with the light as it slipped away, all she had to do was not lose sight of it. To keep her eyes fixed on it intently as if she were trying to win it over. To tame it. Sasha managed to catch it after all, and the little light dragged the girl through the pitch darkness, through labyrinths of tunnels from which she would never have found a way out, to the final station on the line of her life. Things suddenly started becoming visible up ahead. Sasha fancied her guide was tracing out the contours of some distant room where she was expected.
"Sasha!"
A voice called out to her, an amazingly familiar voice, although she couldn't remember who it belonged to.
"Dad?"
she asked warily, thinking she could hear a note of affectionate warmth in the other person's voice. They arrived. The spectral tunnel spark halted, turned into an ordinary flame, and hopped onto the wick of a melted, spreading candle, settling down on it comfortably like a cat that has just come back from a walk. A cool, calloused palm covered her hand. Hesitantly, afraid of sinking to the bottom again, Sasha detached herself from the little light. Following her into wakefulness, pain stabbed through her torn forearm, and her bruised temple started aching. Plain, official furniture surfaced out of the darkness, swaying close by. Two chairs, a locker. Sasha herself was lying on a genuine bed, so soft that she couldn't feel her back at all. As if her body was being returned to her by parts, and some were still waiting for their turn.
"Sasha!"
the voice repeated. She turned her eyes to the speaker, and jerked her hand away. Sitting at her bedside was the old man she had traveled with on the trolley. There was nothing intrusive in his touch. It didn't sting or insult her. She took her hand away because she felt ashamed that she could confuse a stranger's voice with her father's, and out of resentment that the tunnel spark had led her to the wrong place. The old man smiled gently. It seemed to be quite enough for him that she had come round. Looking more closely, Sasha noticed a warm glint in his eyes, the kind of glint she had only ever encountered before in the eyes of one man. It wasn't surprising that she had been deceived, and she suddenly felt awkward in front of the old man.
"Sorry,"
she said. And then recalling her final minutes at Pavelets, she jerked up.
"What happened to your friend?"
She seemed unable either to laugh or to cry, or perhaps she didn't have enough strength left for either. The girl was lucky. The monster's blade-like claws had missed her. That single blow had landed flat. But even that had been enough to leave her unconscious for 24 hours. Her life was in no danger now, the doctor assured Homer. The old man hadn't talked to the doctor about his own troubles. Sasha, while she was unconscious, the old man had got into the habit of calling her that, went limp and slumped back down onto the pillow, and Homer went back to the desk, where the open exercise book with the full 96 pages was waiting for him. He twirled the pen in his hands and carried on from the place where he had abandoned his newly begun book, to go over to the girl when she groaned deliriously.
The latest convoy had been delayed. Delayed beyond any reasonable limit. Long enough for the realization to dawn that this time something terrible and unforeseen had happened. Something against which not even heavily armed, battle-hardened guards and the relationship built up over the years with the leadership of Hansa had been able to protect it. And all this would not have been so bad, if only the lines of communication were functioning. But something had happened to the telephone line that led to the circle. contact had been broken off on Monday, and the team sent out to search for the break had drawn a blank.
Homer looked up and started. The girl was standing behind him, deciphering his scribble over his shoulder. She seemed to be held up by nothing but curiosity. Feeling embarrassed, the old man turned the exercise book face down.
"Is that what you need inspiration for?"
she asked him.
"I'm still right at the beginning," Homer muttered for some reason.
"And what happened to the convoy?"
"I don't know," he said, starting to draw a frame round the title. "The story's not finished yet. Lie down, you need to rest."
"But it's up to you how you finish the book,"
she objected, without moving from the spot.
"In this book, nothing's up to me."
The old man put his pen down on the table.
"I'm not inventing it, just writing down everything that happens to me."
"That means everything depends on you even more,"
the girl said thoughtfully.
"Will I be in it?"
"I was just going to ask your permission,"
Homer chuckled.
"I'll think about it,"
she replied seriously.
"But what are you writing it for?"
The old man stood up, so that he wouldn't be looking up at her from below. After his last conversation with Sasha, he'd realized that her youthfulness and inexperience created a false impression. It was as if, at the strange station where they had picked her up, every year was worth two normal ones. She had a way of not answering the questions that he asked out loud, but the ones that hadn't been asked. And Sasha only asked Homer about things that he didn't know himself. And it also seemed to him that if he wanted to rely on her being sincere and open, and how else could she become his heroine, then he would have to be honest with her himself, not leave things unsaid, and tell her everything he would have told himself.
"I want people to remember me. Me and those who were dear to me. I want them to know what the world I loved was like. To hear the most important things that I learned and understood. So that my life won't have been in vain. So that something will be left after me."
"Are you putting your soul into it?"
She leaned her head to one side.
"But it's just an exercise book. It can get burned or lost."
"An unreliable place for keeping a soul, right?"
Homer sighed.
"No, I need the exercise book to line everything up in the right order, and so I won't forget anything important before the story's been written right to the end. After that, it will be enough to tell it to a few people, and if everything goes right for me, I won't need any paper, or even a body anymore."
"I suppose you've seen a lot of things it would be a shame to forget forever,"
the girl said with a shrug.
"But I haven't got anything to write down, and I don't need to be in your exercise book. Don't waste paper on me."
But you're only just beginning,"
the old man began, and broke off. He wouldn't be there. The girl didn't respond, and Homer felt frightened that now she would clam up completely. He tried to find the right words to take everything back, but only tangled himself even more tightly in his own doubts.
"And what's the most beautiful thing out of everything you remember?"
she suddenly asked.
"The most beautiful, beautiful thing."
Homer paused, hesitating. Sharing his most intimate thoughts with a person he had known for less than 2 days felt strange. He hadn't trusted Elena with this. Even she thought the picture hanging on the wall in their little room was just an ordinary city view. And how could a young girl who had spent all her life underground possibly understand what he might tell her?
"Summer rain," he said, deciding to try.
"What's so beautiful about that?"
she asked with a funny kind of frown.
"Have you ever seen rain?"
"No,"
the girl shook her head.
"My father wouldn't let me go outside. I did go out once or twice anyway, but I felt bad out there. It's frightening without any walls around you. Rain is when water comes falling down,"
she said just to be sure. But Homer wasn't listening to her any longer. He was suddenly back in that day from the distant past, like a medium who has lent his body to the spirit he has summoned. He stared into empty space and talked, on and on.
"It was dry and very hot for the whole month. And my wife was pregnant. It was hard enough for her to breathe anyway, and then this blazing heat. In the maternity home there was just one fan for the entire ward. She kept complaining all the time about how stuffy it was. And because of her I could hardly breathe myself. I was in a terrible state. We tried so hard for years, but nothing worked. And now the doctors were frightening us with a miscarriage. And she was supposed to be in there so she could keep the baby. But she would have been better off lying at home. Her time had come, and nothing was happening. There were no contractions, and I couldn't keep asking my boss for the day off every day. And someone told me that if a child is carried too long, it can be stillborn. I was beside myself. I dashed straight from work to stand guard under her window. My phone had no signal in the tunnels, and I checked at every station to see if I had any missed calls. And then I got a text message from the doctor, "Call urgently." Like a real fool, before I could find a quiet spot, in my own mind I had my wife and the child buried already. I dialed the number. Homer fell silent, listening to the ringing of the phone, waiting for an answer. The girl didn't interrupt him, saving her questions for later. "And they tell me, 'Congratulations, you have a son.' It sounds so simple now. You have a son. But at that moment they gave me my wife back. Raised her from the dead. And then there's another miracle. I go up to the street, and it's raining. Cool rain. And the air was suddenly so light and transparent, as if the city had been wrapped in dusty cellophane. And now it had suddenly been taken off. The leaves started glowing. The sky was moving at last. The houses suddenly got younger. I ran along Tver Street to a flower kiosk, and I was crying from happiness, too. I had an umbrella, but I didn't bother to open it. I wanted to get soaked through. I wanted to feel it, that rain. I can't express it properly now. My son had been born, but it was like I'd been born again myself. And I looked at the world as if I was seeing it for the very first time. Now everything was going to be new. If anything wasn't going right, if anything was wrong, I could fix it. Everything. Now it was like I had two lives. If I couldn't get something finished, my son would do it. We had everything ahead of us. Everyone had everything ahead of them." The old man stopped. He was gazing at Tver Street's 10-story Stalin-era buildings in the pink evening haze, luxuriating in the business-like rumble of traffic, breathing in the sweetish, fume-laden air. And he closed his eyes, turning his face to the summer downpour. When he came to his senses, the raindrops were still glistening on his cheeks, and in the corners of his eyes, proof of his journey back to that day. He wiped them away quickly with his sleeve.
"You know,"
said the girl, seeming just as embarrassed as Homer,
"I suppose rain can be beautiful after all. I don't have any memories like that. Can I remember yours? And if you like,"
she smiled at him,
"I'll be in your book. The way it ends has to depend on someone, doesn't it?"
"It's still too soon," the doctor snapped. Sasha simply couldn't explain to this dry stick how important her request was to her. She filled her lungs with air for another attack, but didn't use it. Instead, she just gestured with her healthy arm and turned away.
"Never mind, be patient, but since you're on your feet, you can take a gentle stroll."
He gathered his instruments into a worn plastic bag and shook the old man's hand.
"I'll call back in a couple of hours. My boss told me to keep an eye on things. As you realize, we're in your debt."
The old man put a soldier's camouflage jacket round Sasha's shoulders, and she went out, following the doctor past the other wards of the infirmary, through a string of rooms and cubbyholes crammed with tables and beds, up two flights of stairs, and through an inconspicuous low door into the vast long hall. Sasha froze in the doorway and took a long time to pluck up the courage to step out into it. She had never come across so many people at once before. She could never have imagined that there were so many people alive in the world. Thousands of them, without masks, and all so different from each other. There were completely decrepit old people and little babies, a huge number of men, men with beards or clean-shaven, tall men and dwarves, exhausted and drained, red-blooded and muscular, mutilated in battle or ugly from birth, excessively handsome or attractive for some elusive reason despite their poor looks. And just as many women, market women with broad backsides and red faces wearing headscarves and padded jackets, and delicate, pale young women in incredibly bright-colored clothes and elaborate beads. Would they see that Sasha was different? Would she be able to hide in the crowd, pretend to be one of them? Or would they attack the outsider, bite the albino to death like a pack of rats? At first she fancied that everyone's eyes were fixed on her, and every accidentally caught glance threw her into a fever. But after a quarter of an hour she got used to it. The people who looked at her included some who were hostile or curious or too insistent, but most of them were indifferent to her. They brushed their eyes gently over Sasha, and pushed on through the crowd, taking no notice of her. It occurred to her that these absent-minded glances, with nothing jarring about them, lubricated the gear wheels of the human bustling, like machine oil. If they took an interest in each other, the friction would be too great and the entire mechanism would be paralyzed. In order to fit in with the crowd, she didn't need to change her clothes or even cut her hair. Instead of that, it was enough to dive into other people's pupils and coldly pull her glance back out after barely dipping it in. Once she had smeared herself with feigned indifference, Sasha could slip between the moving, intermeshing inhabitants of this station without getting stuck at every step. For the first few moments her nose was scalded by the simmering brew of human odors, but soon her nose became less sensitive as it learned to pick out the important components and skip all the others. Weaving their way through the sour smells of stale bodies came the subtle, tantalizing aromas of youth. Occasionally the crowd was bathed in waves of fragrance emanating from well-groomed women, and mingling with them was the smoke from meat on braziers and the stink of the cesspits. In short, for Sasha, the passage between the two Pavlet stations smelled of life, and the longer she listened to this deafening smell, the sweeter it seemed. A full exploration of the boundless passage would probably have taken her an entire month. Everything here was astounding. Stalls with jewelry woven out of dozens of little yellow metal discs with patterns stamped on them. She wanted to examine them for hours. And immense heaps of books containing more secret knowledge than she could ever master. A man shouting his wares at a stand that had a sign saying flowers and a rich collection of greeting cards. The pictures on the cards were faded photographs of all sorts of fancy bouquets. Sasha had been given a card like that when she was little, but there were so many of them here. Babies glued to their mother's breasts and children a bit older playing with real cats. Couples still only touching each other with their eyes, and couples already touching each other with their fingers. And men who tried to touch her. She might have taken their attention and interest for hospitality, or a desire to sell her something, but the way they spoke, in a slippery, breathy kind of tone, gave her an awkward, slightly disgusting feeling. What did they want with her? Weren't there enough local women here for them? And some of them were genuine beauties, too. The bright-colored fabrics they were wrapped in made them look like the half-open flower buds on the cards. Probably they were just laughing at her. Was she really capable of provoking a man's curiosity anyway? She suddenly felt a prick of unfamiliar doubt. At that spot, just below the triangular arch of her interlocking ribs, where the tender hollow began, only deeper, in the place she had only discovered a day ago. Trying to drive away her anxiety, she wandered along the stalls crammed with all sorts of goods, armor, plate, and trinkets, clothes and tools, but they didn't hold her attention so strongly anymore. It turned out that her internal conversation could be louder than the commotion of the crowd, and the human images drawn by her memory could be more vivid than live people. Was she worth his life? Could she condemn him after what had happened? And, most important of all, what point was there to her stupid musings now, when she could no longer do anything for him? And then, before Sasha even realized why this was happening to her, the doubts receded, and her heart calmed down. Listening closely to herself, She caught the notes of a distant melody seeping into her from the outside, where it was flowing along beside the murky current of the multitude of human voices, without mingling with it. For Sasha, music had begun, as it does for everyone, with her mother's lullabies. But it had also ended with them. Her father had no ear for it, and he didn't like to sing. Wandering musicians and similar buffoons were not welcomed at Autozavod. And the sentries droning their dolefully hearty soldiers' songs round the campfire were incapable of drawing real music from the drooping strings of their plywood guitars or the taut strings of Sasha's heart. But what she could hear now wasn't dismal strumming on a guitar. It was more like the tender, living voice of a young woman, or even a little girl, but too high, beyond the range of the human larynx, and at the same time unnaturally powerful. But what else did Sasha have to compare this miracle with? The song of the unknown instrument enchanted the unwary, bearing them off to somewhere infinitely far away, to worlds that no one born in the metro could know, worlds that were impossible, only they weren't supposed even to suspect that. The song set them dreaming and suggested that any dreams could come true. It aroused a vague, indefinite yearning and immediately promised to satisfy it. It made Sasha feel good, as if she had been lost in an abandoned station, but suddenly found a flashlight, and the light of its beam had shown her the way out. She was standing at a bladesmith's booth, right in front of a tall sheet of plywood with various kinds of knives attached to it, from little baby-folding pen knives to predatory hunting knives. Sasha froze, gazing spellbound at the blades, with the two halves of her inner self clashing in a frantic struggle. The idea that had come into her head was simple and tempting. The old man had given her a handful of cartridges, and there were just enough of them for a knife with a broad, sharp, serrated, burnished blade, which was absolutely perfect for what she had in mind. A minute later, Sasha had made up her mind and smothered her doubts. She hid her purchase in the breast pocket of her overalls, as close as possible to the spot with the pain she wanted to stop. She walked back to the infirmary, no longer feeling the weight of the soldier's jacket, and with her aching temples forgotten. The crowd was a whole head taller than the girl, and the distant musician, breathing out his amazing notes, remained invisible to her. Yet the melody was still trying to overtake her, turn her back, make her change her mind. But it was futile. Another knock at the door. Homer got up off his knees with a grunt, wiped his lips with his sleeve, and tugged the chain of the cistern. A short, brownish streak was left on the dirty green fabric of his padded jacket. It was the fifth time he had puked in 24 hours, although he hadn't really eaten anything to speak of. His illness could have several explanations, the old man tried to convince himself. Why did it have to be accelerated development of the disease? It could be something to do with...
"How much longer in there?"
a woman squealed impatiently in a high falsetto. Oh, God, had he really been in such a hurry that he'd confused the letters on the doors? Homer blotted his sweaty face with his dirty sleeve, put on an imperturbable air, and clicked the latch.
"Drunken lout!"
the gaudily dressed floozy exclaimed. She pushed him out of the way and slammed the door shut.
"Never mind," thought the old man. "Better for her to think I'm a drunkard."
He took a step towards the mirror above the washbasin and leaned his forehead against it. As soon as he recovered his breath, he noticed the glass was steaming up and realized his respirator had slid down and was dangling under his chin. Homer hastily pulled the mask back up onto his face and closed his eyes again. No, thinking about how he was transmitting death to every person he met on his journey was unbearable. But it was too late to turn back now. If he was infectious, if he wasn't confusing the symptoms, the entire station was already doomed in any case. Starting with this woman, who was guilty of nothing more than getting taken short at the wrong moment. What would she do if he told her now that she would die in a month's time at the latest? How stupid it all was, thought Homer, stupid and tawdry. He was dreaming of immortalizing everyone that life and fate brought him into contact with, but instead... he had been appointed an absurd, bald, powerless angel of death. His wings had been clipped and he had been ringed, setting him a fixed term of 30 days, and that had galvanized him into action. Had he been punished for his presumptuousness? For his arrogance? No, the old man couldn't keep quiet about it any longer, but there was only one person in the world he could make his confession to. Homer wouldn't be able to deceive him for long in any case, and it would make the game simpler for both of them if they showed their cards. He set off to the hospital wards, walking hesitantly. The ward he needed was at the very end of the corridor, and usually there was an attendant on duty at the door, but now the post had been abandoned, and staccato wheezing could be heard coming out through the crack. It assumed the rough forms of words, but constructing meaningful phrases out of them was beyond even Homer, as he stood there hiding.
Ardor. Struggle. Must. Still. Makes sense. Resist. Remember. Still possible. Wrong. Condemned. But still.
The words merged into a growl, as if the pain had become too intolerable for the man speaking to lasso his scurrying thoughts. Homer stepped inside. Hunter was lying there unconscious, sprawled across damp, crumpled sheets. The bandages bound tightly round the brigadier's cranium had crept right down over his eyes, his protruding cheekbones were covered in perspiration, and his stubbly lower jaw was hanging open helplessly. His broad chest rose and fell arduously like a blacksmith's bellows, struggling to maintain the fire in the body that was too large. The girl was standing at the head of the bed, facing away from Homer with her thin hands clasped behind her back. The old man didn't look closely at first, but then he noticed the black knife that almost merged into the fabric of her overalls. She was clutching the handle tightly in her fingers.
A ringtone beep. Then another. And another. 1,235. 1,236. 1,237.
Artyom wasn't counting them to impress the commander with his diligence. He had to do it to feel that he was moving in some direction. If he was moving away from the point at which he had begun counting, that meant every beep brought him closer to the point at which this insanity would come to an end. Self-deception? So okay. But listening to those beeps and thinking they would never break off was unbearable. Although at the beginning, on his very first watch, he had actually liked it, the beeps had introduced order into the cacophony of his thoughts. Like a metronome, they had emptied his head, subjugating his galloping pulse to their own unhurried rhythm. But the minutes that they sliced up became exactly like each other, and Artyom had started to feel that it was true. He was stuck in some kind of time trap that he could never get out of until the beeps stopped. In the Middle Ages, there was a torture like that. They shaved the offender's head bare and sat him under a barrel with water dripping out, drop by drop, onto the top of his head, gradually driving the poor victim out of his mind. Where the rack was powerless, ordinary water produced excellent results. Tethered by the telephone wire, Artyom had no right to leave his post for a second. He tried not to drink at all during his watch so that the call of nature wouldn't distract him from the beeps. The previous day he'd given in, darted out of the room, rushed to the toilet, and then straight back. He paused to listen in the doorway, and his blood ran cold. The speed had changed. The signal was running faster. It had broken away from its usual measured pace. Only one thing could have happened, and he understood that perfectly well. The moment he had been waiting for had arrived when he wasn't there. Glancing back in fright towards the door, had anyone noticed? Artyom hastily redialed the number and pressed his ear to the receiver. The phone clicked, and the beep started up in their usual rhythm. Since then it hadn't given the engaged signal even once, and no one had answered it. But even so, Artyom didn't dare put the receiver down. He just moved it from his sweaty ear to his frozen one, trying not to lose count. He hadn't told the commander about that incident straight away, and now somehow he didn't really believe the beeps could have sounded any different. He had been ordered to get through, and for a week now that was what he had been living for. If he violated that order, he would end up at a court-martial that saw no difference between a blunder and sabotage. The phone also told him how much time was left to the end of his watch. Artyom didn't have his own wristwatch, but he had checked the time from the commander's when he made his round. The signal was repeated every 5 seconds. 12 beeps was a minute, 720 was an hour, 13,680 was a complete watch. They fell like grains of sand out of one incredibly vast glass flask into another bottomless one, and Artyom sat in the narrow throat between these two invisible vessels, listening to the time. The only reason he didn't dare put the phone down was because the commander could show up at any moment to check on him, but otherwise what he was doing made absolutely no sense. There was definitely not a single living soul left at the other end of the line. When Artyom closed his eyes, he could see the picture in front of him again. He saw the commandant's office, barricaded from the inside, and its occupant sitting with his face resting on the desk, clutching a Makarov pistol in his hand. Naturally, with his ears shot to shreds, he can't hear the phone ringing its head off. The men outside haven't managed to force open the door, but the keyhole and the cracks are still open, and the desperate jangling of the old telephone leaks out through them, creeping through the air above the platform that is heaped up with swollen corpses. There was a time when the ringing of the phone couldn't be heard above the incessant hubbub of the crowd, the patter of footsteps and the crying of children. But now it's the only sound that disturbs the dead. The crimson glow of the emergency batteries blinks in its death throes. A beep. And another. 1,563. 1,564. No one answers.
Chapter 11. Gifts.
Report.
Whatever else about him, the commander certainly knew how to take a man by surprise. Legends circulated about him in the garrison. Supposedly, the former mercenary had been famous for his skill in handling cold weapons and his ability to dissolve into the darkness. At one time, before he settled down at Sebastopol, he used to massacre entire enemy guard posts single-handed if the sentries demonstrated even the slightest carelessness. Artyom jumped up, squeezed the receiver against his ear with his shoulder, saluted and stopped counting rather regretfully. The commander walked over to the duty roster, checked his watch, made a note of the time, 9:22, beside the date, 3rd of November, signed it and turned to Artyom expectantly.
Silence.
I mean, there's no one there.
They don't answer,
said the commander, chewing on his lips. He worked his neck muscles and cracked the vertebrae.
I don't believe it.
What don't you believe? Artyom asked cautiously.
That Dobrynin's been taken out so fast. Is the epidemic already in Hansa then? Can you imagine the bedlam that must have broken out if the ring's infected?
But we don't know, do we?
Artyom responded uncertainly.
Maybe it started already. We've got no contact with them. What if the lines are damaged?
The commander leaned down and drummed his fingers on the table.
Then it would be like with base.
Artyom jerked his head in the direction of the tunnel that led to Sebastopol.
I dial and it's completely dead, but with them at least I get the signal. The equipment's working. Base clearly doesn't need us since no one comes to our door anymore, or maybe there simply isn't any base left, and no Dobrynin either,
the commander said flatly.
Listen, Popov, if there's no one left there, then we'll all croak soon, and that makes our quarantine pointless. Maybe we should just drop it, what do you think?
He asked and chewed on his lips again.
Definitely not, the quarantine's essential,
said Artyom, crossing himself in fright at his own heresy and recalling the commander's manner of first shooting deserters in the stomach and reading them their sentence afterwards.
Essential,
the commander repeated thoughtfully.
Another three feel ill today, two locals and one of ours, Akopov, and Aksyonov died.
Aksyonov?
Artyom gulped hard and squeezed his eyes shut.
He smashed his head open against the rail, said the pain was really bad.
The commander went on in the same even tone.
And he's not the first. It must be one hell of a headache for a man to spend half an hour down on his knees trying to crack his skull, eh?
Yes, sir.
Artyom suddenly felt sick.
No nausea? No weakness?
the commander asked considerately, pointing his flashlight into Artyom's face. Open your mouth. Say, ah. Good man. I tell you what, Popov, you get through to Dobrynin, and get them to tell you Hansa has a vaccine and the medical brigades will be here soon, and they'll save all of us who are healthy, and they'll cure everyone who's sick, and we won't be stuck here in this hell for all eternity, and we'll all go back home to our wives. You'll go back to your Galia, and I'll go back to Alyona and Vera. Got that, Popov?
Yes, sir,
said Artyom, nodding vehemently. At ease. His machete had broken off at the handle, unable to support the weight of creature that collapsed onto it. The blade had pierced so deep into the carcass that they didn't even try to extract it. And the man with the shaved head, covered in slashes from the beast's claws, still hadn't come round after almost 3 days. There was nothing Sasha could do to help him, but she had to see him anyway, if only to say thank you. Even if he couldn't hear her. But the doctors wouldn't allow the girl into his ward. They said that all the injured man needed now was peace and quiet. Sasha didn't know for certain why the man with the shaved head had killed those men on the trolley. If he had fired in order to save her, she could absolve him. But although she honestly tried to believe it, she couldn't. Another explanation was more plausible. It was easier for him to kill than to ask for anything. But at Bavalets, everything had been completely different. There was no doubt about it. He had come for Sasha, and even been prepared to die for her. Did that mean she hadn't been wrong after all, and some kind of connection really had started developing between them? When he called to her that time back at Kolomenskoye, she was expecting a bullet, not an invitation to move on together. But when she submitted and looked round, she had noticed the change in him immediately, even though his frightening face was still as impassive as ever. It was in his eyes, as if someone else had suddenly peeped out through the loopholes of those motionless black pupils. Someone who felt curious about her. Someone to whom she now owed her life. She wondered if she should